Take a network break. Get on board our new weight loss program with the All Virtual Donut Diet and distract yourself from the hunger pains by listening to our weekly tech news commentary. We've got stories today on Cisco, Nutanix, Amazon, and more. I'm Drew Conry Murray, and with me is Greg Farrow, and we're pleased to welcome our guest, Keith Townsend. Before we jump into the news, I want to thank our sponsors. This episode of Network Break is being brought to you by IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV is an easy, entertaining approach to online IT training. And for a free 7-day trial and 30% off the lifetime of your account, go to itpro.tv/networkbreak and use the code NETWORKBREAK30. Also, thanks to our sponsor, ExtraHop. ExtraHop is the leader in real-time IT analytics and a pioneer of wired data, the ultimate lens into digital transactions. The ExtraHop platform provides insight across the entire IT environment, from the data center to edge devices to the cloud, helping IT leaders make data-driven decisions that enable them to optimize performance, security, and customer experience. If you tweet at ExtraHop and mention Packet Pushers, you'll get a free t-shirt. Okay, jumping into the news, our first story, baby steps for optical white box. So white box switches are establishing a little bit of a beachhead in data center networks, and now optical white boxes are getting a little toehold in the service provider and carrier networks. And Greg, this is a story you churned up. There's a German company called Avda that's announced it's got 9 customer trials going on with some carriers and service providers.
Oh, yeah. So this comes out of the Open Compute Foundation. This is another Facebook kicking the networking vendors in the nuts again with a solid, big, heavy boot. This time, because this time they're taking eyes at the optical switching market. They're taking generic merchant silicon, dropping it into a standard chassis, and then putting ROTMs or the optical gear straight on the end. This is absolutely the sweet spot where the optical companies just harvest up huge high profit margins for not much effort at all. So it's a bit like what Whitebox has done for the enterprise market. You know, it's trying to disrupt the apple cart and brought the average price of the hardware items down. Admittedly, prices haven't gone down across the board, but that's mostly because it's in the optics, right? So be careful about that. This is a company, this is one of the biggest suppliers of optical gear, is actually doing a 9-site trial. So with customers, selling out these open optical boxes that came out of Facebook and snapping it into their SDN controller system and saying to customers, let's see how this goes. Let's run it up and see if it works. So I think that's pretty major. 9 customers, not 1, 9 customer trials is substantial.
So if this is a company that actually makes optical gear, are they potentially undercutting themselves by going white box, or are they just trying to get out in front of a beating?
Well, I think we've seen the carriers get really excited about cutting the costs or cutting the cord from the vendors. They basically need to cut the price of bandwidth is dropping down. The revenue that they make per bit is dropping substantially, and it's already rolled off in 2016. And from 2017 going forward, they're going to make less money out of private WANs, MPLS, internet access. That business is pretty much all done, right? And they have to find a way to make cheaper networks. But if you're working with a vendor who wants to make more expensive networks, where does the break? And so coming up with white box hardware is a way to break the vendor hold and start saying, you know, you need to get into this. So for Avda, I think they've recognized that this is a software-defined future, and the operating system on the box is the key, not the box itself. And so let's get in there early and see if we can take some market share away from our competitors. I don't think they've got much to lose, to be honest.
Yeah, from an enterprise perspective, I'm shocked at how cheap wavelengths are from like the West Coast of the U.S. to the Midwest and to the East Coast. The prices have come down amazingly low. But what's even more surprising is when I go to spec out, or when the team goes to spec out the hardware needed to terminate these connections, that becomes the cost prohibitive portion of it. It's not the recurring revenue or the recurring expenses of the actual circuit anymore. It's literally the endpoints.
Yep, that's right. And exactly like white box switches, all of the components inside of an optical packet box are all off the shelf. So you can go and buy the ROTMs and the Ethernet switching fabrics. It uses the same Broadcom chipsets and so on and so forth that you use for Ethernet. It just happens to be that they read optical at the edge, and all the money today, you go to a company and buy the ROTMs or the SFP modules that go in to connect to the optical interfaces, and you pay well over the odds to have them because they, you know, they've got super magic powers in them or something. But you can also just buy them open source, like you can buy third-party SFPs today for Ethernet. Same applies to the optical gear. There's been several moves afoot over the last 5 years to do open optical, and there's really, for a certain group of customers, this would be a way of getting things happening. And of course, remember that Facebook is in this because more bandwidth is more Facebook. And so lowering the cost of telco services backhaul, just get the prices down, then you're going to start to see more bandwidth and more services to be deployed. So Facebook's that's its interest in that part of it.
So, Greg, I'm curious, how does this help with the higher end? So companies like mine will go out and get more and more 10 gig connectivity, which is what Facebook wants. What does that mean for that aggregate market for when you need to aggregate all of those connections at that Facebook or at the service provider level? Where does this play in all of that?
So I think what you'll see is the point is that the hardware matters less than the software that sits over the top programming the path. If you've got a single optical interface and you're running 48 by 100 gigs on top of that, and so you've got 4.8 terabits per second of bandwidth, how much does it cost you to light that up? And today you pay per bandwidth. So instead of paying for the SFPs and paying for the switch, you actually license each Lambda. So the ROTM itself has all the functionality built into it. But if you want to buy 6 ports, 12 ports, 24 ports of that 48 by 100 on that single file, it's actually just a license. So the costs are you know, really out of whack. You know, they're trying to charge for consumption, but customers don't do that. Customers pay to roll this stuff out. If you have a white box solution, then all of a sudden your sparing changes. So your ability to hold spares, your ability to run it as a network, like having one operating system across your carrier network, instead of having today, if you buy an optical network from Infinera or from Ciena or from any of the other optical providers, you're locked into that one company. There's no multiple multi-platform way of managing the different optical products today. And you get locked into that, whoever it is that you have. And you can't then put an OSS or a BSS system on top that operates. So can I get billing data out of the network? And can I just click a button and provision it? No, you can't, because all of a sudden over here is the, you know, here's my Ciena network and over here's my Cisco DWDM and optical. And they're not even remotely compatible. Not deliberately not. Each vendor deliberately keeps the cells proprietary and shut off, prevents interoperability because they want to lock the customer into them for a 5-year, 10-year, 15-year agreement.
Yeah, so that was a question that was coming to my mind. Part of the deal with Enterprise White Box isn't just about the lower cost of the switches. It's because you can get this kind of operational benefit of choosing your operating system, finding an operating system on the switch that fits into your operational practices, your tool chains, and getting that software benefit as opposed to just a hardware cost savings.
Now, most people in the enterprise aren't buying white box because they believe that dealing with the big vendor offers them some value. You know, they have better quality software or better support, or there's value being added. But there are customers who are buying white box for whatever reason it suits them. It's about these choices. So some carriers are going to start saying, you know, I could design my network using these Voyager white boxes from the telecom infrastructure project, and I could build a very viable network at a fraction of the price that's got better speed, better configurability. So that's really where it is. And the fact that one of the big vendors has gotten behind this sort of signals that there's momentum from the client saying, AT&T just announced that it's going to spend $40 billion on a network refresh over the next 2 years. That's $20 billion a year, give or take. Who do you think is going to win that money?
I'm sure there's a lot of people fighting for
it. Yeah, that's right. But I mean, there's a lot of money in here. So if you could rock up to somebody like AT&T, I mean, that deal's already so far down the pipeline, you know, blah, blah, blah. But if you can rock up with a product that says, look, we're using these low-cost hardware boxes, that you can run them in these parts of the network. Sure, in your core of your network, you might want to run the legacy stuff, you know, that costs a lot of money if you want to be happy. But maybe there's a part of your network at the edge where you could run this white box where the impact is limited. And guess what? You're then in a leading position.
All right. Well, this is something to keep an eye on. Let's move on to story two. A private equity firm is buying Blue Cat Networks. Madison Dearborn Partners, they're a private equity company in Chicago, are acquiring Blue Cat Networks. They do DNS and IP address management. The amount of the deal wasn't disclosed, but according to a press release, the goal is to accelerate growth.
We've seen so much activity around DNS in the last year or so. We saw Dyn be acquired by Oracle. We saw OpenDNS get acquired by Cisco. So a private equity firm has done the numbers on buying Blue Cat Networks and decided to do the same thing. Obviously, DNS is like the new oil. Just seems to be everywhere these days.
I thought it was interesting. Blue Cat's management team, they're going to remain in place and keep a stake in the company. A lot of the private equity deals we talk about are about a public company being taken private so that they can, you know, restructure and rejigger. It doesn't sound like this is happening here because Blue Cat wasn't public to begin with. So they aren't exiting the market. They're just finding another way, I guess, to capitalize and grow.
I think they're getting funded up so they can make a pivot. So if they were privately owned before, or just, you know, they might not have had the cash to go and invest. So most of these DNS companies like Dyn and OpenDNS have become cloud malware companies. It's no longer just enough to have like an appliance that does DNS. You've got to have some sort of value adding, some cloud DDoS protection or cloud security, you know,
yeah,
good domains, bad domains, you know, that sort of stuff. Like a lot of people use OpenDNS at home to filter out undesirable destinations and protect the children from seeing stuff they shouldn't see. That's great. But Blue Cat was particularly targeting DNS appliances to the enterprise, and then all of a sudden the DNS market changed. So where do you go? I guess you go to private equity who are willing to fund you to turn it around, invest a little bit to build a new business, and then that's the way it'll go.
So a few months ago, we had Denial of Access. Well, what was it? Was that to Dyne, whichever one of these big providers that took down half of the internet?
It was Dyne that got hit by DDoS, yeah.
Yeah, so as enterprises look towards, you know, the Blue Cat, Dyne, and OpenDNS, and whomever, to kind of mitigate the risk across several DNS providers, it sounds like we naturally create another problem of interface to DNS and aggregating DNS and managing DNS. I couldn't imagine being the poor schmuck in my enterprise that had to say, okay, Keith, we use Dyne today. We want to spread that risk across three providers and integrate the processes and being able to automatically update DNS between three different providers. I don't think there's any, not that I know of, there's not standards of how you integrate into the APIs and the back end of these providers. I think there's opportunity there because of the of what was highlighted a few months ago, but I think there's also opportunity to, you know, how the heck do you manage multiple DNS providers?
But there's somebody right now thinking up a cloud service to do that.
Yeah, I think we'll see a cloud service. And I think Keith's got a good point. You know, it is actually quite difficult to use these interfaces, OpenDNS and Dyne. And ultimately, configuring DNS is a massive, there's a great deal of uncertainty here. So when you evaluate risk in various operations, it assumes that you actually know what you're doing and you can identify what's risk. And DNS, you cannot actually predict what's going to happen. If you make a change in the DNS, there's unpredictable outcomes. And so it's hard to use multiple providers because they all operate differently. They have different interfaces, and DNS is a bit of an esoteric art unless you've done it quite a few times over a long period of time to know how it all works. So yeah, you make a good point, Keith, but nobody can really fix those things. Those are inherent to DNS.
I got a solution. We'll integrate DNS and BGP.
They're trying to do that. You know that.
I know. I have hardly joked about that, but I'm sure there are several solutions out there doing.
People doing weird things. I think the thing about DNS is that it is complicated, but I believe that Blue Cat in this particular question had an appliance that did DNS, added some value. The market's pivoted underneath it. The idea of selling a single hardware appliance or a software appliance to do DNS has made them, you know, their long-term future unviable. So now they're pivoting to somewhere else, and they went into private equity to make that pivot, I think.
All right. Story three, S3 coughs, the internet catches a cold. As you may have heard this week, Amazon's S3 object storage service suffered a 3-hour outage, disrupting lots of businesses that rely on S3 to serve up files, images, etc. Other Amazon services were also affected by the outages. And Amazon actually, just before we came to start a recording, they published a postmortem, and it turns out this was human error.
Yeah, somebody took too many servers out of the cluster, apparently, when they were feeding stuff into their automation tool. They took too many servers out of the cluster. Read it. It's wonderful because at least they didn't blame the person, right? They didn't say it was human error. They just said somebody made a mistake and our software didn't detect it. I think the main thing that happened here, perhaps the most embarrassing part about this, is when S3 goes down in US East 1, which is the first and most primary of the Amazon sites, turns out the status page icons were hosted on there and the icons couldn't change from green to red. And so it showed us up. Well, it was definitely down.
Oh, the irony.
So if you're a customer who's been basing your stuff on AWS 3, obviously you've just learned that each availability zone is actually not fully available. It's not 100% uptime. There are reasons why private enterprise has these tools to do active high availability. And it's probably, you know, the AWS sense of invulnerability has had a bit of a kicking this week, just reminding people. How long has it been since the last outage, Drew? Was it a year ago they had a big outage around S3?
Yeah, I can't remember. It's been a while. We haven't talked about a major outage, yeah, for a while.
Yeah, I just wonder if people have kind of forgotten the last outage. Like, they don't happen often enough. It's a bit like when the data center crashes. For the first, about 6 weeks after the data center outage, everybody gets upset and runs around and promises to fix everything. And a couple of months later, everybody's forgotten. It's
back to business as usual, yes.
Back to business as usual, and it's on the list, but there's other things that are more important. And, you know, 6 months or a year or two later, the same thing happens again. Everybody goes, why didn't we fix this last time? So.
Well, we should be clear that Amazon makes it very clear that you can set up their systems across multiple availability zones, and you potentially should if you're relying on them for your business. But it's always a question of the cost and the complexity of doing that. And customers have to decide, do I want to risk the outage or do I want to pay the money to set up across multiple availability zones?
That's right. And it's worth remembering that the S3 SLA, so the S3 storage service, the SLA is only 99%. So you should expect or be planning for a day or two's outage per year around AWS S3. So they didn't even breach their SLA agreements, not even remotely. If you're expecting AWS S3 to have a 5.9s, which it doesn't promise, they only promise 99.9 and a 99, it does, if you look up the SLH page anyway. But if you're thinking they're going to get 5.9s, it'll take them 30 years to get 5.9s back without a single outage in the next 30 years, by the way.
Wow.
Yeah, so, and the two frustrating points about when AWS goes down. One is that I then get a ton of press releases and inquiries about, you know what, let's comment about how we could have helped you not do that. I'm like, oh, come on. If AWS can't keep up their service, I don't trust a startup from Oklahoma to do that for me either. The
fortune passes everywhere.
Yeah. And then the other piece about the SLA, you know, you look at the, I went and read this SLA, and it's just like all these crappy enterprise SLA agreements that will credit you on the maintenance or the service. So my service was down for 3 hours and I get $10 back. But, yeah. Oh, well, thanks a lot, Amazon. I guess I can order something. Are you going to give me 20% more if I take it on an Amazon gift card?
You can rent a movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're not going to get down is down. And you know, if your app stopped working and there was a lot of them and they really shouldn't have, you need to be using multiple availability zones and you need to know how to detect an S3 failure or a failure of any, just like you do with your enterprise apps. And that's why you run a private cloud, because if the data center goes down, you can run out there and fix it often quicker than whether you can do it better from S3 from day to day is, well, that's a different argument. But at least you can do something about it instead of sitting there helplessly going like, I'll just wait for Amazon to fix it. Maybe that is attractive to some people. I don't know.
I want to say tip of the hat to Amazon for their outage postmortem. It was very clear. They fessed up. They outlined what happened and talked about steps they're going to take so that it won't happen again. That kind of clarity, I think, is very reassuring for customers.
Yeah, and they didn't blame a person. They just said there was a failure in our internal process, our whole failure, and it's our fault. Take it.
Yeah. Would maybe like to be a fly on the wall inside for that poor person who did make this change, but who knows what kind of kicking or screaming they got, but... Yeah, they aren't hanging a specific individual out to dry publicly. All right, story four, storage and server revenue declines. There's new data from IDC and Gartner showing that server and storage revenue is shrinking. On the server front, global revenue growth shrank year over year for major server vendors. IBM and Lenovo posted declines of 17 and 16% respectively. And HPE, which is the market leader, according to IDC, saw declines of almost 13%. The one bright spot was for Dell, which is second place in the market. They enjoyed a tiny increase of 0.1%.
Yeah, this is the story that I keep saying about the enterprise is slowly shrinking, and this is the evidence that it's still happening. That's really all I wanted to say. It's just that we talked about the server declining last week, storage is this week. 2 weeks ago, we talked about Cisco declining sort of 2 or 3% across the board in the enterprise market space. Sorry, 4 to 5% in the enterprise, including their server division. So, yes, the enterprise is definitely in decline, and it's going to continue for some time. There's no signs of it slowing down. That's really all that I wanted to highlight here.
Yeah, so quickly on the storage side, most of the storage vendors saw year-over-year revenue go down, including Dell EMC. Their revenue went down 17.3% globally, though IDC did note that ODMs, which sell to hyperscale organizations, were the one group that saw a revenue increase. So a little data point there.
Mm-hmm. I think the enterprise has got a lot of spare capacity, and they're just halting. And they're consuming that extra capacity instead of just endlessly buying more stuff just in case. That would be my guess. What do you think, Keith?
Yeah, I think we're waking up. You know, from a practical perspective, a lot of that SS capacity is getting, I don't want to say absorbed, because absorbed is the wrong word, is getting augmented. The extra capacity cloud actually injects more capacity into the enterprise. So a lot of projects that I think a lot of enterprises plan, and the infrastructure teams assume that our internal customers would come to us, they're actually going out to cloud. And it exacerbates the problem of SS capacity. Doing capacity planning while you're integrating cloud into your operations becomes more difficult because you have this unknown infinite capacity outside of your data center that it's really hard to plan for.
Yeah. I think it's also clear why EMC sold itself to Dell too. A year over year revenue decline of 17% in storage is like, ow, that's got to hurt.
Got to hurt a lot.
Although yeah. I did have a very high Dell executive instant message me about kicking HPE when it's down a little bit, saying, you know what, you can't shrink your way to growth, and highlighted how well Dell EMC is doing now that they have a much, much bigger organization.
That'd be a tough argument to make. I see that HPE got rid of a lot of underperforming business units that were very much based in the legacy space, and they were a problem. They weren't modern. They weren't containing, you know, like the HP software division they sold off to Micro Focus was just full of this legacy software that nobody wants to buy in a decade's time. Why would you keep it? Shrinking to grow actually makes sense in that context.
I think I agree with that argument. I really like their purchase of Simplivity. I think HPE is on the right path. Get out of legacy businesses that they couldn't make work together. They've changed leaderships, I don't know how many times in the past 5 to 6 years. No one could make that big organization work well together. You know what? Just blow it up, start over with the core of that business and start to grow out. I thought it was a great strategy. We'll see if it pays off.
Yeah.
We're going to be talking about HPE a little bit later in the show, but first I want to tell you about one of our sponsors, ExtraHop. They're the leader in real-time IT analytics and a pioneer of wired data. That's the window into digital transactions. They provide insight across the IT environment, from the data center to the edge to the cloud, helping IT leaders make data-driven decisions that enable them to optimize performance, security, and customer experience. For too long, IT has been thought of the network as either the plumbing or the problem. But with ExtraHop, the network actually becomes your biggest source of real-time visibility for IT. That's because ExtraHop does the analysis first and stores packets last. This is what they call wired data, which encompasses all the interactions between IT systems and the organizations that rely on them. Wired data is rich, real-time, observed, and objective. Analyzing at scale transforms the network from a transport function to the foundation of all digital experience. With ExtraHop, companies like T-Mobile, Google, Adobe, McKesson, Netflix, and Expedia save millions of dollars and thousands of hours, improving application response times to more than 70% and mean time to resolution by up to 90%. If you want to learn more about ExtraHop and try it for yourself, visit them at extrahop.com/demo. And if you connect with them on Twitter, at ExtraHop, mention Packet Pushers and you'll get a free t-shirt. ExtraHop, it's instant insight for IT. Okay, story 5, Cisco Contiv goes for container networking. Cisco has announced Contiv 1.0. This is an open source container networking fabric.
Yeah, this has been in the works for quite some time, 2 or 3 years, I think, Cisco's been developing this. So it's good to finally see it break out into the open. It is an open source project. You can literally go and download it from GitHub. I think the most unique things about this is that it's very foundational to a Docker. So this week, combined with this announcement, and maybe we should have led with the fact that Cisco and Docker have teamed up at a strategic level. So Cisco's aiming to work with Docker to provide a networking stack for Docker that really enhances its capabilities. Today, the Docker is like a modular, and you can snap in anybody's networking functionality, SDN particularly. So if you want to, the Docker interface is modular, and you can go and snap in your OpenContrail or your NewArch networks or your whatever it is. But for Cisco, Contiv is key because now they have a container strategy that works with all of the SDN solutions that Cisco's got, at least in theory. And they're touting the fact that it works with things like Cisco's ACI. So good to see that out in the open. And congratulations to the Contiv team for sticking with it over a fairly long period of time. And nice to see also Cisco's got an open source project away.
Keith, any comments?
You know what? No, not really. I'm still trying to keep up with how to install a virtual ASA in Amazon AWS. I spent the week frustrated with that, so I'll look at this once I figure that out. This stuff is moving frustratingly fast in containers and container networking and Cisco getting involved with it and me trying to understand what they're doing with SD-WAN and adding so-called features to existing products. Wake me up when we're at kind of like version 6.0, which might be next week.
When it's actually working. Okay, so I agree with that, although Cisco does, of course, spend a lot of money on marketing. And so for those people who know, they have the Cisco validated designs. I will point you to the Cisco Valdez design for Docker data center on Cisco's UCS. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. It's a really useful way of getting up to speed about what this announcement looks like. I didn't get to go too deeply in it, so please don't hang me on it. But Cisco always has great documentation, and I've got a link to the tutorial on how to get it going. That's there as well if you want to go and have a bit of a play and get familiar with the idea. But it is good to see that Cisco's finally gotten into the container market and is going to bring its SDN platforms like everywhere. As you would expect, Cisco to have a networking solution for all the different things. So, you know, vSphere, the physical network, the WAN, the LAN, and now they've finally got something for containers that they can own and control and convince customers to buy.
So, Greg, help me out with this one. Mm-hmm. When do we know when Cisco's truly serious about a particular market? Like their SD-WAN solution, no disrespect, but I'm going to say something disrespectful. I don't like it, and I don't know many people that do. And you look at it, you're like, you know, this is kind of half-arsed. When do we know to actually pay attention to some of these announcements from Cisco?
So the usual, my rough guideline for any Cisco announcement is you should wait 3 to 5 years. Cisco likes to, has had a long history right the way back from when it started back in the mid-90s of announcing product early and then releasing something which really isn't fit for purpose so that customers can evaluate it and then going to the customer and saying, is this what you want? Is this what you want? And then iterating on it. Now, quite often these first announcements of products are actually dysfunctional. They're not fit for purpose. They've just been released way too early. But that's the way Cisco's always done business. It's not necessarily a critical thing. And customers should realize that any product that Cisco releases, like take, for example, Cisco ACI, 3 years ago when it came to market, I said to people, stay away, be careful. I don't think it's ready to use. 3 years later, what are we seeing now? Customers are just beginning to get into ACI and starting to give positive feedback on the product and saying it doesn't crash, it doesn't work. So my rough rule of thumb is from announcement to the time that you should start to consider to buy it should be about 3 years.
Yeah, one of the things that really woke me up about this as a customer is the whole Cisco cloud collapsing. For some customers, that was a big, big bet. And I just couldn't imagine going into my CIO's office. You know, there's this whole you never get fired for buying Cisco. But if I put Cisco's cloud in front of my developers and said, this is the way to go, this integrates with our networking constructs, and this is just operationally the right decision, that's kind of setting my personal stake in the ground and going in front of my CIO and saying, no, we'll buck Amazon, we'll buck Azure, and even Google, and we'll go with Cisco's enterprise class because, hey, Cisco understands the enterprise. And then just say, you know what, around this time, that cloud will be shutting down. That's an awful lot of egg on my face, not from Cisco's perspective, but me personally, if I stated part of my reputation on going to an extended team saying this cloud is the cloud to use. So I didn't bet on Cisco clouds, but I am a little bitter at what that probably looks for some of my peers.
I think the mistake that people make is they think because it comes from a big company, because a product comes from a big company, that it's going to be something they've put their weight behind. And historically, that was true because customers would always buy whatever a big company put in front of them, a bit like McDonald's. People always eat McDonald's when you put it in front of them. It's probably not healthy and it's not the best solution, but they'll buy it because they just know and trust that particular brand. But increasingly, the big companies are stumbling. So I would say that when you consider, you know, look at products that have been announced by HPE with their Helion cloud, you look at IBM with their cloud, you look at all the other clouds that are out there, you look at all the products that have come out more recently, what we're seeing is about a 50% failure rate. So when the big companies bring a product to market, about 50% of them don't last 2 years before they're taken up and thrown away. So this 3 years that I was telling you about sort of includes that 2 year death cycle of products that are floated up and to the top and they ship and then they see how many customers like them. And if they don't like them, they delete them and throw them away. So your job as an architect or as a technology lead is to be able to sit there and say, it's too early or this is too out there. You know, the risk here is that this product may actually never survive. And increasingly with the big companies, they're being outcompeted by startups. And so they have to kill off services faster and earlier than ever before.
So let me throw this at you, Keith, and see what you think. The fact, one, this is an open source project, so it's there. Cisco is involved in it, but there's also a code base that's going to live beyond Cisco. Does that allay any fears that you might have about this going away at some point?
So the challenge is that it seems like it's oil and water. I don't go to Cisco for open source. Mm-hmm. I go to Cisco because I'm too lazy to do it on my own. And for Cisco to, you know, shoot something out there that's open source and say, hey, don't worry about it because it's open source. Well, I go to my big vendors because I can't retain the talent, or I can't attract the talent, or I don't have the skill to build it on my own. So even if I have the code, if this thing goes away, it does me no good because I go to Cisco for a packaged solution.
Well, it could be a lot like, you know, when they acquired company that was built around Snort, which was an open source IDS system. They bought the company that was built to make a commercial version of Snort, but they actually continued with Snort as an open source project, I think partly to allay the open source community's fears, but also because they realize there's a business model here that can be successful. So I presume Cisco is going to have some kind of Cisco-branded front end on top of this open source project. The second thing is, I don't see this necessarily being worried about it could go away in 3 years, because Cisco needs to be in container networking. Container networking is where things are going to move in terms of application development. And if Cisco doesn't have something for its core base of network engineers who are out there trying to figure out what their developers are up to, then that's a loss for Cisco. So I think this is something that they're going to get behind and stay behind.
And I think the expectation is with tools like Docker that developers care about it being open source. They don't want to have to go and raise a purchase order to start working with it. If the ops, and there's kind of like, I have this model, like if the operations people are crazy enough to go and buy purchase orders for this free software, well, I'm not going to stop them. Or, you know, or if there's an ITIL project manager, it says if it does, whatever, that's fine. But we're just going to go ahead and get started with the open source. And if you say there it is, go and get it. I think things have changed literally. So the world that we live in is that some people want to be able to buy a product from Cisco because they expect to pay for it. But there's other people who expect to get it with the minimum amount of friction, and open source is that.
Well, it will be interesting to see what happens when the bill comes to pay, because there's always a bill. You know, open source developers within your organization might adopt this tool, and mm-hmm. you want to move this tool from kind of this open source, not supported dev test environment into production and support, and you need to get production support. And now you have to go to Cisco and get that support. Presumably, that'll be an interesting contracts conversation, I think.
Mm. Yep. But like you said, Drew, Cisco had to play in this space. They had to have something.
They did, yeah. All right, this is definitely something we're going to keep an eye on, but let's move on to story 6. The Yahoo CEO loses her bonus over security breaches. Marissa Mayer won't be getting her annual cash bonus of approximately $2 million. This is according to a story in The Guardian. Mayer is also foregoing an annual stock grant that could also be worth millions of dollars. This financial penalty is a result of the company's poor handling of a security breach that exposed personal details of over a billion accounts.
Yeah. So, hey, all that security stuff, maybe there is some costs. I still think they're better off by not having done any security, right?
This is something we talked about last week. Yahoo, you know, maybe Marissa Mayer saved the company a lot of money by not spending on security. So maybe it was a good thing, but apparently they felt like something had to be done. And so a $2 million, I guess that's more than a slap on the wrist. Maybe a punch in the stomach. I'm not sure.
Well, Verizon got, what did they get?
$350 million discount on the acquisition price.
So they got $2 million back out of Marissa's bonus.
Yeah.
And then I think the other thing is that she's actually promised to she's distributing the bonus to the employees. That just sounds like a way of gilding that lily, right?
Well, she asked the board, let's just take this $2 million and give it to everybody else. I don't know if the board has said yes, but I did the math and that would come to about $235 per employee if they spread it around.
Well, that's going to make it sweet. $230, you'll be able to have a nice dinner somewhere in the state.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. Wow.
I'm looking at this Recode article and it seems like Marissa Mayer's 2016 stock award for 2017 was about $14 million. So while $2 million is quite a bit of money, personally, I don't know how much money that is to Marissa. And also, without digging in, you know, CEOs usually get a piece of the action when they sell the company. And for a $4 billion sale, I'm pretty sure her piece of the pie makes that $2 million look like, you know, chump change.
Not to mention the sign-on bonus you got when they lifted her from Google. So, she's not poor out of this. Let's keep going.
Losing $2 million would be a life-changing event for me, considering I haven't had ever $2 million. But, yeah, I'm sure she'll be fine. We don't have to feel too bad for her.
I don't think so.
All right. Speaking of millions of dollars, SD-WAN startup VeloCloud, they've raised $35 million. This is a D round of financing. The company has raised $84 million to date. VeloCloud in 2016, they notched some big customer wins, including AT&T and Sprint, which are going to use VeloCloud to offer SD-WAN services to their own customers.
So SD-WAN continues to roll on. So money pouring into VeloCloud. There's two things I wanted to raise here. One was that the Series D, so this is their D round of funding, which is quite deep, is lent by a whole bunch of investors, Telstra Ventures, Khazanah National Bearhead, the Strategic Investment Fund of the Government of Malaysia. In addition to existing investors, new enterprise associate, Venrock, March Capital Partners, Cisco Investors, and other undisclosed strategic investors. That's like, man, that's a big boardroom.
That's a lot of people who want to get a return too.
Well, it's just going to be, who's going to be making the decisions in there? That's a lot of people sticking their finger in that pie. And the fact that they've raised $35 million to do SD-WAN, that doesn't sound like a lot of money to me. That sounds pretty light when you're thinking that Viptela has already got a valuation in excess of $1 billion and doing sales at a very large number. Why is VeloCloud only raising such a small amount? Now, I understand that VeloCloud is only cloud only and it's software and blah, 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 but still not a lot of money, really. There's something here that doesn't ring quite true.
And then I'm just overall looking for when this market matures to the point that there's a shakeout. I think you guys were tracking the number of SD-WAN startups at some point. It can't be sustained. So I'm just wondering when there's the shakeout.
You know, I'm not sure. I actually coming to the view that it might actually be sustainable.
Really?
I think at the end of the day, there's a fundamental difference. When you've got routers and they're communicating together, they all have to be having this, and you have these really hard to use command line interfaces. It makes sense to have the same router everywhere across the world because you need to have it consistent. But the way that SD-WAN and the use of SDN and the way that the new operating systems, you don't need the CLI, everything's done from a central console or from the cloud, the reduction in operational overhead for these means that you don't need the things that trigger your buying decisions are radically different. So I'm not 100% sure, and I'm not by any means saying I've got a final decision here, but I actually think this might be a market that will fragment completely. This is not a winner-takes-all market. It might be 5-10 players, each with products in slightly different spots. You know, there might be a Riverbed, a Silver Peak, a VeloCloud, an Ariaka, a Viptela, you know, all the players, Tutlari, and Cisco is just one of the many. Instead of Cisco taking 60 to 80% of the market, this might actually be a very different market.
So I wish there was an audio version of the emoji sad face.
Yeah.
Put emoji sad face. I'm an enterprise guy. I want 3 or 4 solutions to choose from the most. You're making my RFP process really hard here, Greg. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
It's really difficult.
I think it's really time the enterprise grew up and got on with this stuff, buddy. And we need to get into making choices instead of just having choices made for us.
But I'll tell you, actually, I talked to a customer of a SD-WAN company, and he said, Keith, one of the hardest parts about this wasn't selling it to his bosses. It wasn't the technical deployment. It was the RFC, because so many of the solutions on the surface are essentially identical that it took him a long time and a lot of effort to drill down into, okay, where are they really different and how is my purchase decision really going to square up? And so this testing and decision process was very difficult, in part because of the large size, the number of opportunities, and two, because they are essentially functionally the same, that drilling into, you know, what are the actual little aha, gotcha moments going to be with this actual product was very difficult. I think that's a great point.
Especially if you're in an organization that you're forced to go through a POC process.
Right.
That I couldn't imagine that nightmare. Well, actually, I could imagine it, but...
Yeah, but proof of concepts prove nothing. I'm very hostile to the whole proof of concept. I've seen such vast amounts of money wasted away on proof of concepts that prove nothing. You know, like you go to do a proof of concept thinking that it'll prove your design and the vendor gives you zero guarantees. Just because you did something, they'll tell you, they'll sit there and say to your face, you say, look, let's go and spend $500,000 doing a proof of concept. You go and do the proof of concept and then you say, well, and then it breaks in operation and you say to the vendor, well, you've got to fix it because you know, we tested it and it worked in the lab. And they say, worked in the lab, does work in the real world. You're on your own. Customer, you're screwed. So yeah. Why are we bothering to do a proof of concept? Why don't you just do a field trial?
Yeah, the proof of concept is not for, in my experience, it hasn't been to actually prove that your concept works. It's to tick the box to your local contracting office that you've done some level of due diligence and someone won't get fired.
Yeah, I believe we have to change the way we think and the way we operate. We've got to get away from this. I have to suck it and see. I have to play with it before I'm confident that it works. because we're actually letting the vendors off the hook. Why is it that we let the vendors off the hook and say, yeah, we'll pay you $500,000 to do a proof of concept because we know your product is faulty. Therefore, we have to test it before we work. That's, you don't do that with a car or a hamburger. You don't go and buy a car and then hand and say, actually, you know what? I'm going to pay you $5,000 so I can drive it for 6 weeks to see if it actually works.
That's a good point.
Pox, rubbish. Absolute crap idea. I get angry about them, just in case you hadn't noticed.
Yeah, that's why I brought it up. I listen.
All right, before Greg's blood pressure gets too high, let's take a moment to thank our sponsor, IT Pro TV.
This episode of Network Break is sponsored by IT Pro TV, and they'll help you gain your IT certification if that's what you care about. They've got a whole raft of important tools, over 2,000 hours of high-quality video content. Courses are streamed live and on demand with your favorite device. You can watch them wherever, including the Apple TV, if that's your particular poison. One of my favorite things to recommend to people is get it on your mobile device and then watch it during your lunch break at work. Upcoming course topics include cybersecurity analyst, CCNA CyberOps, ITIL Operational Support and Analysis, and Microsoft System Center. If you're into the track of getting some certification, there's step-by-step virtual machine lads and access to the Transcender practice lab exams, which can really help you get through it, especially if you get stressed by an exam. One low monthly subscription price, a no-hassle cancellation policy. Premium annual memberships are normally $57 a month or $570 a year. But we have a special offer for Packet Pushers listeners. Try it free for 7 days and get 30% off the lifetime of your account when you sign up at itpro.tv/networkbreak and use the code networkbreak30. That's less than $400 for an entire year. That's less the cost of a router that you'd normally pay on eBay. It makes a hell of a lot more sense. Give it a go. Get over to itpro.tv/networkbreak. Use the code networkbreak30 to get 30% off the lifetime of your account and get yourself started. Get to learn something. Even if you're not going to do an exam or a certification, just get in there and learn stuff. Best way to get your career ahead.
Learning is good. Okay, let's get back to the news with Story 8. Nutanix gets hammered. They lost 16% after hours. Nutanix reported their quarterly earnings. They beat Wall Street, but its stock price dropped as much as 16% in after-hours trading because of a weak forecast.
Yeah, bad day for Nutanix because it was the darling of Wall Street just a few months ago when they listed on the stock exchange. And so while they are 77% up year over year, so revenues of $182 million, which is not too bad considering, they reported only 9% up quarter and quarter. So it's not that they suddenly stopped selling or having troubles. What they were doing is they were expected to continue to grow very strongly, and all of a sudden it's flatlined, and they're just not closing big deals. So customers are actually pushing back and saying, particularly they called out in the transcript in the call to the various analysts saying that they lost a lot of big deals. Well, they didn't lose them, they just didn't close them. And then normally they rely on $400,000 to $500,000 or more deals to put their numbers over the line, and they just weren't able to close them. And the fact that North American sales slowed down dramatically. They blamed this on their salespeople. Basically, they said the sales team isn't working, so they're ditching a whole bunch of them, promoting the ones that work, and then talking about sales productivity. Get used to this term, sales productivity. You're going to hear more of it today. So not that Nutanix is in trouble. It's just that they're not able to close some deals, and their forward projections are down. Their share price was, you could take the view that it's certainly overpriced. There's been a lot of excitement that Nutanix was going to take off like you wouldn't believe, but in fact, crashing down on the reality that too much investment in sales and not enough time to execute.
All right. Full disclosure on this. I've been told by Nutanix people that I'm biased against Nutanix. So I'll embrace my bias against them with my comments. This is something we talked about on the end of the year podcast and looking about what's changed in the enterprise. Absolutely nothing. I've challenged Nutanix on this in the past. Basically, they need to differentiate themselves. HPE buying SimpliVity, I think, might have a lot to do with not closing those deals. Nutanix labels themselves as a cloud company. They need to get there. The label doesn't match, I think, the reality. They have a great opportunity to bridge the gap between non-differentiated hardware services to truly being a scale-out cloud company, private cloud, delivering that vision that VMware has yet to deliver on and many other private enterprise companies such as HPE. So Nutanix has opportunity, but I'm thinking just from a customer's perspective that the reason that the sales have slowed down is because I need to understand why go with Nutanix over HPE from a practical sense now that they have SimpliVity.
Or even Dell EMC with their VxRail and their renewed push around converged systems there. So yeah, they're getting into the V blocks and reaching down into the Nutanix space. Cisco UCS, they've got, oh, how many different hyperconverged partners have they got? Like 20? They partner with basically every distributed storage company to build a converged system. And I think Nutanix has got competitors. And I agree with you. I'm not convinced that Nutanix is going to grow like it did. And I think they've done pretty well to get their share price listed at the peak. And I don't see a whole lot of upside from here.
Yeah, I think they're fighting against the nature of enterprises that we like big, large companies. The solutions don't have to be great. They just have to meet the basic needs. I think Nutanix has a great solution, but they're still relatively a small operation compared to the HPE, Dells, and Cisco's of the world. So yeah, it's a tough trading. I'm hoping that they innovate, because innovation is good.
Yeah. Just to flag that, the revenues for the quarter was $182 million. Cisco sales for this last quarter was $800 million to $1 billion in UCS, and HPE is more like $4 to $5 billion per quarter. So yeah, quite tiny by comparison.
All right, and sticking with companies that are getting hammered despite having a good quarter, Palo Alto, their stocks took a nosedive despite a strong earnings report. They saw the stock price drop by almost a quarter despite posting quarterly revenues that were up 26% year over year. The quarter came in lower than at least one analyst firm was anticipating, however. I guess Wall Street is worried that Palo Alto's growth is slow, which is in part due to high product price, but also some vigorous competition from Cisco, Check Point, and others.
Yeah, this is another one where a product that's been highly touted. So Palo Alto is one of the first people to get into this next generation firewall, or the application firewalling market. And they've been, again, promising the market stratospheric growth to continue forever. And particularly in the last quarter, they were spending up heavily on sales, and they were questioned by the analysts several times on having so much money spent on sales and marketing. And so any sort of a failure means that the money that was invested on sales and marketing wasn't working. And that's what they said. Again, sales productivity is the word. In other words, the salespeople aren't closing deals. Now, why would they not be closing deals? They didn't say, and we can't point the finger at any particular one thing, but my guess would be some people are out there. There's a storage here from MarketWatch saying that Cisco's starting to get its next generation firewall story in order. And they'd be right. They were actually Cisco's getting away. Checkpoint's starting to reorient itself towards the application firewall market. And so maybe Palo Alto's got a harder fight against it, and it's going to have to start thinking about pulling back. So they rightly predicted into the next quarter that they say they don't know why, they don't know what the problem is, but sales are down and they're predicting much lower revenues in the quarters to come. So the stock tanked, down 22%. I think it's down 27% now, which is quite a lot. So bad, Dave, if you're a Palo Alto Networks stockholder.
So snide comment, you know what? Enterprises are realizing from the Yahoo breach, we don't have to spend money on security. So, hey, there you go.
That's right.
I'm on board with that viewpoint.
All right, our last story for the day. There's lower server demand from Microsoft, which is hurting HPE. Bloomberg's reporting that Microsoft is buying fewer servers from HPE. Both HPE and Dell are competing with ODMs that offer commodity machines at lower prices, particularly for the web scale giants. And Bloomberg in a story notes that Meg Whitman in last week's earnings call said that there was a significantly softer demand from a tier one service provider without saying who that service provider is. Now Bloomberg is saying, yep, that was Microsoft.
Well, they're surmising, I think, you know, making stuff up just from anecdotal evidence. There's no actual fire here. But it is true that Microsoft did announce last year that it's got a new in-house cloud server design. And we know that Microsoft has been moving towards making its own switches as well for top of rack. So it makes sense for Azure to start moving towards its own servers. And any time it starts to buy servers instead of buying them from HPE and Dell, that's going to come straight off their bottom line. I believe that Microsoft might have been like 5 to 10% of total sales.
Wow.
I'm not sure. I could certainly be wrong here. Like, they buy a lot of servers, right? They've got a lot of locations and they buy them in mass. So any shift here would actually be substantial to HPE. And so that's likely. We missed this last week. I deliberately left it out because I didn't see that particular line. And when I picked it up later on, I thought, there's really no smoke here to say who it is or why. But this particular article from Bloomberg is just someone guessing that it's Microsoft, because in previous quarters, HPE has listed Microsoft as a substantial customer.
So alternative theory, maybe it's not just technology that Microsoft is moving to their own internal technology. Maybe it's because they didn't get any of that $2 billion in Snap money and data center and cloud services that Snap spends on cloud providers. I just have to pick with this. I know we don't do much consumer talk, but Snap debuted at like 50% their expected market cap. It's ridiculous, but it's also an indicator of where the money is going in cloud providers. $1 billion to, I think, one provider in AWS, another $1 billion over 5 years. Yeah. $2 billion.
$600 million to AWS and $2 billion to Google.
Yeah, so I have to imagine for Microsoft Azure, that is material that they didn't get part of that money, and it inadvertently or indirectly, rather, impacts HPE.
Uh-huh, that's a good one. I could go with that. There's as much evidence for that as there is for the Microsoft pulling out of buying servers from HPE, to be honest.
Yeah.
And we'll never know if Dell does, because they're private now and they don't have to say it in public. So, hey, there you go.
All right, some competing ideas, but that brings us to the end of this episode of Network Break. Greg, where can folks get more from you?
People can find me on my blog at Ethereal Mind, where I'm doing sort of microblogging, little thoughts, little nuggets. But I write my long-form articles on packetpushers.net. You can follow me on Twitter as at Ethereal Mind.
And I'm Drew Conry-Murray. I'm on Twitter at Drew_CM, and I blog at packetpushers.net. Keith, thank you for being a guest on the show. Where can folks find you on the interwebs?
Thanks for having me on. You can find me on Twitter at CTO Advisor, and then you can find the blog and the podcast, which I don't think I've published at all this year, at thectoadvisor.com.
Get on that mic, Keith.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks to our sponsors, IT Pro TV and ExtraHop. And thank you for joining us for another episode of Network Break. If you like the show, give us a like on Facebook, leave a recommendation on iTunes, or share it with your friends. And please check out our newsletters. That's Human Infrastructure Magazine and Link Propagation. They are free. You can also find lots of other fine free technical content at packetpushers.net. Thanks for listening.